This Dharma Talk is brought to you by the Chicago Zen Meditation Community. Learn about us and our teacher, Miyoshi Thompson, at zenchicago.org.
Good evening, all of you. It's very nice to see you. Those of you that have heard some of my previous Dharma Talks know that I often discuss current events. But tonight, I am not going to dwell on bummer news events, and I am not even going to mention the person MSNBC refers to as the disgraced ex-president. Instead, I want to continue a thread that Miyoshi started several weeks ago when he discussed the work of Ian McGilchrist on the differences between the two sides of the brain. Remember a little bit about that? We've been reading this book in a study group, and we all think that McGilchrist's work is tremendously rich and important. I can't do it justice in a brief talk, but his major points that I want to emphasize tonight are these. We've basically gone down a wrong path in our culture, and it's because we have prioritized the activity of the left hemisphere over that of the right. I will expand on these ideas and then discuss how I think Zen offers a brilliant and perfectly designed remedy for this. You might recall that Miyoshi talked about McGilchrist pointing out that organisms have to solve the problem of seeking out prey while at the same time avoiding being prey. And the solution in regard to brain development is to have one side of the brain that specializes in deploying focused, narrowly focused attention, like the shorebird turning over mollusks or watching for fish. This is the left brain. But that bird still has to watch out for the larger predator that might make a meal out of it. So it also has to pay broad, vigilant attention to the bigger picture, what's going on in the environment, and that also means it has to pay attention to novel and unfamiliar elements. And this is the specialty of the right hemisphere. In using both sides of our brains, we have a helpful combination of being able to see the fine details without losing sight of the big picture. And apparently all organisms have this left-right division, so it's clearly been very helpful for survival. But for humans, McGilchrist thinks that for at least a few hundred years, we have prioritized the functioning of the left hemisphere to the great detriment of ourselves and the world. The left hemisphere is structured to manipulate the world and to deal with details. It tends to view what's in the foreground and what is easily grasped. It's good at breaking things down and seeing their parts. However, the left hemisphere tends to be overly optimistic that it's correct. And it thinks it understands, even while it's collapsing complex events into simple black and white things that really miss a lot. The left hemisphere wants to see things as familiar. It comes up with a model and it sticks with it. It even suppresses sensory information that runs contrary to the model. Basically, it values control and power to manipulate things. Whereas the right hemisphere is more focused on understanding the world as a whole. It's better at observing and dealing with the unfamiliar. It's the side of the brain involved in sex and love. The right hemisphere is much more able to tolerate uncertainty and ambiguity than the left hemisphere. The right hemisphere enables an appreciation of music. It's essential for empathy, and generally it just has a more open attitude. McGilchrist contrasts the vision of reality held by the left and right hemispheres. For the left, the world is composed of isolated, fragmentary elements that can easily be manipulated, but are detached from issues of beauty, morality, and human significance. Elements are put together like brick on brick to build a wall, reaching a conclusion that then the left hemisphere is completely certain about. McGilchrist says, it is an inanimate universe and a bureaucrat's dream. There's an excess of confidence and a lack of insight. This view is useful for purposes of manipulation, but it is not a helpful guide to understanding the nature of what it encounters. McGilchrist believes that the vision of the right hemisphere is a more accurate representation of the complexities of the world. It's more like the world itself, rather than the map of the world, which the left hemisphere would like to take as the only reality. The right hemisphere is the world of physics and poetry, in which everything is flowing and changing, and in which everything has to be understood in context. McGilchrist says that the view of the right hemisphere is truer to what is, but it is also harder to comprehend and it is difficult to put it into language. He says, it is an animate universe and a bureaucrat's nightmare. He stresses that we need both of these two ways of seeing the world. They're both vital to survival. We need to be able to simplify things and manipulate details, but we also need to understand the world and its complexity and to deal with moral values. The division of attention can work to our advantage when we use both, but he stresses that it is a handicap and even a catastrophe when we use only one. He notes that far more of us than ever before in the history of the world now live divorced from nature, alienated from the traditions of a stable society, and are unconcerned about spirituality or what he calls the divine. These three elements have always provided humans with a sense of belonging and meaning. But for the last 300 years or so, we've had an excess of hubris, so that nature is seen as merely a resource that we can exploit. The divine is considered superstition. And we think that our technology and bureaucracy and law can enable us to control the world. As I noted, the left hemisphere intellect is not aware of its limitations, and it sees itself as the master rather than the apprentice of a broader view. And the consequences have been catastrophic: environmental degradation, exploitation, colonization, and the destruction of the way of life of indigenous peoples. We act with disregard for beings of the planet now, other beings, and for future generations. Social cohesion breaks down with an excess focus on individuality, and we're seeing an epidemic of loneliness, depression, and anxiety. We're seeing the triumph of black and white judgments, especially in the culture wars, worsened by social media and an absence of context. Workplaces have been taken over by a check-the-box mentality and a focus on narrowly measured productivity rather than creativity and quality. Perhaps some of you have such experiences in your workplaces. I've certainly heard about this from any number of people. The left hemisphere's motivation is control, and it sees things in a very linear fashion, and it tends to operate in this way. If something doesn't work out, just do more of it. McGilchrist includes a quote from the physicist David Bohm about thought, who said, "One of the obvious things wrong with thought is fragmentation. Thought is breaking things up into bits, which should not be broken up. But I want to say that you don't decide what to do with the information. The information takes over. It runs you. Thought runs you. Thought, however, gives the false information that you are running it, that you are the one who controls thought, when actually thought is the one who controls each one of us." McGilchrist notes that Bohm is vividly describing how the left hemisphere, cut off from emotion, cut off from the body, wants us to believe it knows best, pretending to serve well-being, but actually just wanting to control. McGilchrist notes that our current values of individualism, personal autonomy, and control are not making us happy, despite the fact that we relentlessly seek personal pleasure. Satisfaction and happiness ratings in modern societies that have been researched have all declined as they have become more prosperous and westernized. There are fewer suicides in lower income groups compared to higher income. And rates of suicide are lower in traditional societies compared to modernized societies. A psychologist who studied rates of psychopathology in teens from 1938 to 2007 found that between 5 and 8 times as many students met a cutoff for psychopathology on this particular measure, psychopathology such as depression and paranoia, in the latest cohort compared to the earliest. So 5 to 8 times more. Other research has shown that loneliness is worse in each successive generation. McGilchrist suggests that if you had set out to destroy the happiness and stability of a people, it would be hard to improve on our current formula. Remove yourself from the natural world, dismiss tradition, repudiate social structure, and believe you are wise enough to do whatever you want and get away with it. Here's an example of the absurdity and danger of our current left hemisphere-oriented culture. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court will hear a case that will determine whether private citizens may own automatic weapons. The case involves bump stocks, devices that cause a semi-automatic firearm's trigger to bump the trigger repeatedly so that the gun fires as if it is automatic. Bump stocks were banned in 2018 after the Las Vegas shooting in which they were used. And there's a 1986 law that makes owning a machine gun a crime. But now a gun owner wants to own bump stocks and has brought a case, which is going before the Supreme Court, suggesting that they should be legal. Federal courts are divided on whether bump stocks create a machine gun. Federal law defines a machine gun to include any weapon that can shoot more than one shot without manual reloading, using this phrase, by a single function of the trigger. But courts are divided on the meaning of this phrase, a single function of the trigger. Does it mean a single pull of the trigger from the perspective of the shooter, and therefore a bump stock does create a machine gun? Much of the Fifth Circuit Court concluded that a bump stock equipped gun does not count as a machine gun because the trigger itself moves back and forth. It's unclear what the Supreme Court will do, but given its current makeup, it would not be surprising if at least some members opine that a bump stock equipped firearm is not a machine gun, and therefore private citizens, including 18-year-olds, mentally disturbed individuals, and domestic abusers will have legal access to weapons capable of firing up to 9 bullets every second. Okay, I said I wasn't going to talk about bummer news events tonight, so I won't dwell on this case, but I think it's a useful example of a culture that's gotten so caught up in legalistic details like what defines a machine gun in terms of trigger action, and a focus on individual rights, that we lose perspective on the broader issues of what kind of society do we want to have. So I hope you might be finding McGilchrist's view that our culture has taken a wrong turn with left hemisphere dominated activity running amok to be compelling as I do. So what can we do about it? Well, it turns out that what we are all doing tonight, coming together to practice a spiritual tradition that's been around for millennia, is exactly the right hemisphere-oriented activity that can serve as an antidote to the left hemisphere problems I've been discussing. Many research studies suggest that in meditation, a definite shift toward right hemisphere activation takes place. This has been documented in Zazen, yoga, and transcendental meditation. Right hemisphere dominance is seen in studies of altered states of consciousness. And this is a bit of a tangent, but it's so interesting that I wanted to tell you about it. You might know there's been quite a bit of research documenting paranormal phenomena such as mental activity affecting physical events, although this research tends to be ignored and dismissed by the left hemisphere oriented scientific community. McGilchrist cites some fascinating research suggesting that experimental suppression of some left brain activity could significantly increase a subject's ability to influence the numerical output of a random number generator. That is, with left hemisphere suppression, the right brain was more able to basically perform what is looked at as paranormal activity, mental events that can affect physical function. The authors of the study concluded that the left hemisphere regions that they suppressed here usually might inhibit or filter out these abilities, which run counter to orthodoxy. But in this experimental paradigm, the right hemisphere was permitted to just do what it can do, which I thought was really quite cool. McGilchrist notes that a disposition towards spirituality largely depends on the right hemisphere, which makes sense, right? Because it's more open to the unfamiliar. It's more comfortable with not knowing the answers about life and death and our place in the universe. It has more tolerance for ambiguity and paradox, whereas the left hemisphere wants things to be simple and familiar. McGilchrist discusses a few cases of people who had left hemisphere strokes, and they reported that following their strokes, they had a new interest in spirituality and meditation. McGilchrist states that spiritual practices such as meditation are purposely designed to transcend typical left hemisphere reactions of verbal analytical thinking. Let's take a look at the instructions Dogen gives us for Zazen in Fukan Zazengi. You should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words, and following after speech. He also says, cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros and cons. Cease all the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. And finally, he admonishes us to think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking, sometimes translated as beyond thinking. Could any instructions be more perfectly designed to help us break out of our typical left hemisphere over-focus on thinking? In many ways, I believe the process of doing Zazen involves catching ourselves, doing our usual left brain stuff, planning, problem solving, fantasizing, ruminating, and then reminding ourselves to take the next breath and let go of all that. I had to laugh at myself in Zazen in the past week because I knew I would be giving this talk about trying to shift into right hemisphere activation in meditation, but my left brain wanted me to plan my talk and kept chattering to me about points I wanted to make. That left hemisphere blah, blah, blah is very persistent. And for me, one period of Zazen doesn't shut it down all that much. But more practice can be really helpful. So I want to underscore what Miyoshi was bringing up about our upcoming session in the middle of March. It is wonderful to have the opportunity to do more sustained practice from Friday evening through noon on Sunday. My experience is that having more periods of Zazen makes my left hemisphere get bored with its usual planning and preoccupation. and it becomes easier to open up to the present moment. I want to encourage all of you to see if you can attend all or part of that session with us and give your right hemispheres a little more room to roam. In addition to Zazen, our Zen teachings offer other ways to disrupt our usual left hemisphere activity. Koan study was specifically designed by Chinese masters to stop students from engaging in what was called their word drunkenness. The intellectualizing tendencies of students did not lead to satisfactory koan solutions. That was more likely to result in a smack or a put down from the master. Breaking free of the typical limiting thought habits into something more authentic and spontaneous and experiential was the desired result. Muman, author of a koan collection called The Gateless Gate, wrote that enlightenment always comes after thinking is blocked. For example, here is the koan titled An Oak Tree in the Garden. A monk asked Joshu why Bodhidharma came to the West. Joshu said, an oak tree in the garden. The left hemisphere says, wait, what? Here's one called Tozan's 3 pounds. A monk asked Tozan when he was weighing some flax, what is Buddha? Tozan said, this flax weighs 3 pounds. And again, the left hemisphere goes, what? Here's another called Basho's staff. Basho said to his disciple, when you have a staff, I will give it to you. If you have no staff, I will take it away from you. None of this computes for the linear, rational, logical left hemisphere, which might be inclined to dismiss such dialogues as stupid or nonsensical. But here are some further words of Muman. To realize Zen, one has to pass through the barrier of the patriarchs. If you want to pass this barrier, you must work through every bone in your body, through every pore of your skin. You should feel like drinking a hot iron ball that you can neither swallow nor spit out. Then your previous lesser knowledge disappears. Goes on a little bit more. When he enters this condition, his ego shell is crushed, and he can shake the heaven and move the earth. I take this as describing a wholehearted, full-bodied right hemisphere experience that is more likely to occur because the left hemisphere's usual means of logical analysis are blocked. We have a Saturday morning study group in which we've been reading Dogen, and it's really a trip. Probably half of what we read leaves our left brain saying, I don't get this at all. We read the Mountains and Waters Sutra, and it contains lines like these. The mountains and waters of the present are the realization of the words of eternal Buddhas. Both mountains and water abide in place in the Dharma, having realized ultimate virtue. Because they are in the state before the kalpa of emptiness, they are vigorous activity in the present. Because they are the self before the sprouting of creation, they are real liberation. The virtues of the mountains are so high and wide that we always realize moral virtue, which can ride the clouds by relying on the mountains and unfailingly liberate the subtle effectiveness which follows the wind by relying on the mountains. Any questions? We're currently reading a piece on Buddha nature with lines like these. You must know with certainty that within entire being it is impossible, even with the greatest swiftness, to encounter sentient beings. Understood in this way, entire being is in itself completely and totally emancipated suchness. I find much of Dogen's writing to be beautiful, poetic, and fairly incomprehensible. But we have an interesting process in our study group. We use a couple of different translations, and that really helps to clarify certain words and points. And we share our ideas with each other. So we kind of have the left brain analysis covered. And I think we just try to open to the unfamiliar material so that our right hemispheres can take it into such to some degree. We're often left with some intuitions and some felt sense about what Dogen is saying, and it's an enjoyable process. If we engage with Dogen's writings using only our left brains, I think we would have given up in frustration long ago. To conclude, McGilchrist states in the strongest possible terms that our over-focus on left hemisphere activity is causing us to commit suicide as a culture. And he notes that our survival and that of the planet are at stake. Zen's emphasis on wholeness, wisdom, and compassion is an antidote to the power and control oriented left hemisphere mode. Its practices of Zazen and Koan study are designed to thwart the usual habits of the logical and wordy left hemisphere and flip us into more tolerance of paradox and ambiguity. All the more reason for us to heed the words of teachers such as Dogen on the need for diligent practice. In Fukan Zazen, he says, "You have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not use your time in vain. You are maintaining the essential working of the Buddha way." I'd say we need it more than ever.